Imagine earning continuing education credits while doing exactly what you're doing right now. Well, you can. Gable Media has revolutionized the way you earn your continuing education credits with a groundbreaking approach. Forget running around town and scouring the internet for credit-worthy courses. Fulfill your CE requirements effortlessly by listening to engaging podcasts just like the one you're listening to now. Our podcasts are designed to educate, entertain, and inspire, all in a user-friendly environment. But wait, there's more. Architects, Gable Media is also approved as an AIA Continuing Education Services provider. Upon completion, we handle everything, from reporting your hours directly to the AIA to storing your certificates in your personal Gable Media profile for your self-reporting needs. So follow the link in the show notes and start earning your credits in the most innovative and entertaining way possible with Gable Media.
My name is Mark R. LePage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. My guest today is Adam Katz, founder of Cradle, a platform built to bring clarity and structure to the pre-construction process. With a background that spans Wall Street, construction, and software development, Adam brings a rare perspective to the challenge of aligning design intent with real-world construction costs. For small firm architects, that gap between vision and budget can create friction, stress, and lost profit. Today, we're talking about how better pre-construction process can strengthen collaboration, protect margins, and lead to better outcomes for everyone involved. Adam Katz, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. Let's jump right into your origin story. I would love to know more about you. When did you discover your passion for what you do today, and who or what inspired you to get started?
You know, I think I've always been in love with real estate and architecture. I was one of those kids that you couldn't pull off of the Lincoln Logs or pull off of the Legos or pull off of whatever it was that you could build things out of. And I always loved it. I also grew up in New York City, and it was interesting. You know, I was in New York when the city wasn't considered to be a terribly desirable or safe place to live in the 80s. And you watched...
I remember those days.
Yeah, that Times Square was a very different place. And so I remember watching buildings being erected in the city and saying, God, how do they do that? And I would just stand there and stare at job sites and watch equipment working. And, you know, ultimately I found my way to the West Coast and went to school at Arizona State and went to school for finance and for architecture and continued to love it out here. It was a really different, you know, view of what architecture is. Obviously the terrain, the environment, the environmental conditions are really different. The needs are very different. And I just really loved watching cities get developed for entirely different sets of reasons with entirely different sets of motivations. And I always found that to be exciting. And as I was going through school, I really, really enjoyed creating wonderful spaces, warm spaces, spaces that people actually wanted to spend time in. And that was very interesting. And I continued to do that. So while I went to school, I was, and this was in a different day and age, you know, it was in the mid 90s, but back then I was able to, and I had a great mentor, a real estate developer who was a mentor of mine that co-signed for me on my first couple of properties. And I came out of school with some rental properties and continued to develop, you know, and continued. I started flipping and then I started tearing houses down and then I started looking for open lots. And I've done over 200 custom homes. When I say I've done it, I mean, I've designed it, funded it, brought it to market. And I've been the person, you know, who's in some cases hired architects and, you know, I always hire engineers and designers and contractors. And I've been the person standing in between all these people that I've contracted and paid and still finding things out in the field. And to me, that was always very troubling. And my path was kind of odd in that I did not pursue architecture after school. I wound up going and working on Wall Street. I started at Morgan Stanley. I had helped build a small research, trading, and investment bank, and did that for about 12 years. And all the meanwhile, I continued to develop real estate, you know, single family, custom luxury residential homes in Phoenix, and loved it. And the reason why I didn't go into it is because when I was an undergrad, I met plenty of happy people in finance, but I was struggling to meet architects that seemed happy at that time. They all seemed, at least the ones I was meeting in those days, seemed to be not terribly thrilled with their career choice, and it made me apprehensive about doing it, but I still loved it. And so I just continued to develop. So about in 2009, when the world was left for dead, I kind of came to the conclusion, and this is just my own personal opinion, but I came to the conclusion after being on Wall Street for 12 years that a lot of what they were doing, a lot of the things that I was doing were actually dilutive to the U.S. economy.
Yeah.
That seemed to be a good time to kind of segue into, you know, recreating myself and forging a new career. And in Phoenix, after 2008, the real estate market here was left for dead. And there were a lot of really desirable neighborhoods where homes were trading at 50% or less of their replacement value. So I had this crazy idea, we'll start a company. And if you can't find a house that you want, and there's no such thing as construction, there wasn't anything, construction loans had come to a screeching halt. So you could come to us, we would take your requirements, buy a house, redesign it, redevelop it, and deliver it to you finance ready. And we did 65 projects in 3.5 years.
That's a great idea.
And it wasn't actually, it was a terrible idea. It was my first time being in a...
Really?
Well, I'm speaking to an audience of architects. So I think everybody here that listens to this podcast would know that the customers really don't understand or often value what we do.
Right.
Or what an architect, you know, or a landscape architect does. They certainly didn't understand the whole supply chain. They didn't understand the civil engineering components and the structural and mechanical and electrical and plumbing, and that interior design, when it's done correctly, is actually not picking out pretty pictures, but understanding how assemblies come together. And so it was a very capital intensive business with low margins, and banks weren't giving the value on the other side they should have, which ate directly into our margin. And we were really trying to build value around the supply chain. You know, in other words, how does a project come to be and make it not so stressful for the homeowner? That business lasted 4.5 years before I threw in the towel, but I learned a lot in that period of time. And so that kind of brought me to where we are today with Cradle.
Before you get into Cradle, I have a question about that 4-year business. Do you think that that business would have been more successful as spec homes rather than working with clients who don't understand the process?
No, with the benefit of hindsight, absolutely. I mean, any one of those 65 houses that we lined up for sale, we could have held on to any one of them, rented them, and made a great cash flow return and sold them 4, 5, 6 years later for more than 2 times what we were into it for. So
yeah,
certainly the spec model was the right model. I mean, I have clients who spec, I've spec'd, I understand, you know, that business. But I think for me, the passion, and I don't know why this is a passion of mine, I don't know what it says about me, nothing particularly interesting, but I've always been really interested in the customer experience. It's this really odd field where everybody has done a little remodeling or knows somebody who did remodeling or built a home or watch HGTV. There's a lot of people who feel that they're surgeons because they've watched ER.
Exactly.
And it's a really dangerous place to be. And so the customer journey is often, you know, a customer calls some friends and says, where should I start, with an architect or a builder? The friend expresses their opinion. They take that advice. Maybe today they go to ChatGPT and ask and get even more confusing information. But they're effectively calling around and looking for referrals. And, you know, and they tell whoever they're sitting in front of all the things that they want to do and show them pictures and draw things on napkins. And then they look the contractor or the architect in the eye and say, well, so how much and how long? How much is this going to cost? And how long is this going to take? And that's a really tough question to answer, you know, particularly right, because you may not have, you know, I mean, you may not have heard everything. And the interesting thing is that they do that 3 or 4 times with 3 or 4 different contractors or architects. And then they open up our proposals and they look at the last page, and whoever has the lowest number is who they go with.
Yeah.
And that is a terrible way to select an architect or a builder. And so I really wanted to create a process that kind of cut through a lot of that noise. And we see it all the time where customers say, well, we just want to have you guys design something for us. We want to have you bring something to life so that we can see what our architects and designers have designed. And then we'll go find a builder. And I share with anybody who's willing to listen that that's a terrible idea. You want your builder to acquire tribal knowledge of your expectations and what you want along the way, and you're not giving them the ability to do that. And your architect and your engineers are going to want somebody to rely on, if they can, to know what kind of equipment are we speccing. And so the better your team is, the closer you can get to what's actually going to happen in the field, the more you're mitigating rework, you know, and mitigating risk. And it's taken me a long time to figure out how to get to that point. And we're still not perfect, you know, not by any stretch. But that's been an obsession of mine, is how customers come into this market where it's really fragmented and there's very few understood standards.
Yeah. And that's why we tell the origin story, because it leads you to where you are today with Cradle. So tell me how Cradle was born and what it is today.
Yes. So Cradle is really the inverse of the company that I described I started in 2009, where instead of trying to do everything, we're doing one thing. We're the information hub in the middle of it. Phoenix has been an interesting market. You know, we've gone from being a really immature market that was just dominated by regional builders and national builders to, you know, having a real groundswell of not just population growth, but young professional population growth. You know, we've seen semiconductor companies put a stake in the ground out here. It's really becoming an interesting technology and healthcare research type of center. And so the needs have changed. And we've also seen the emergence of just incredible architects out here. I mean, we really have a very, very impressive community of very, very talented architects out here. I could say the same about our builder community out here as well, and our engineering community and our design community. And so as I'm looking at the landscape, and I was trying to think about what I wanted to do when I got up in the morning, at first I thought, well, maybe we'll just go back to building houses and, you know, designing building houses and being design build and doing a half a dozen great projects a year. But the need that I really saw in the market was just this lack of a communication hub, you know, and that everybody is kind of designing in a silo. And, you know, the architect is doing his thing and the interior designer is doing her thing and all the engineers are doing their thing, and whatever clashes or errors or omissions or things get missed, you know, because there isn't an information hub, that just gets worked out in the field, and it costs time and it costs money and it costs bad feelings. You know, and if you worked at Gensler or you worked at Hadid, 30% of their headcount today is allocated to building information modeling and virtual design construction. A lot of times if you work for a boutique and you've been working in CAD or ARCHICAD or whatever tool it is that you're working in, it's really hard and it's expensive to be able to build out a platform that gives you that kind of leverage and efficiency internally. So Cradle is the inverse of my, you know, of trying to do everything. And now we're just doing this one thing. And it's really about making sure that everybody is creating a singular version of the truth. So we work with a lot of architects where they give us their work in whatever format they want to give it to us in, and we express it back to them in a BIM. Is this what you meant? If they're deferring trusses, which happens a lot out here, we're going out to the builder and saying, well, let's get that truss design going so that we can model that and model your ducts and make sure that we're not beam locked, that we're not going to have clashes that are going to be discovered in the field. We take all the interior design specifications and selections and put them in a model, and we will put virtual reality headsets on customers or do, you know, big presentations on large screens so that they can move through their house and really understand it. And it's a fascinating experience, because a lot of times, you know, we see this in every meeting all the time with clients, you know, where they didn't want floor to ceiling windows there, they wanted bifold doors, but the architect missed that detail, or the interior designer designed something that just wasn't going to work for them, but they didn't understand it when they were looking at a 2D elevation. They needed to see it to really understand it. So in our typical project, and our typical risk mitigation project, where we're basically perfecting the architecture and the engineering in a singular model, and then also perfecting all the things you can see inside and outside the house in a visual model, our average customer makes over 70 changes. And this is typically from the time that most people would consider them to be pretty design locked. And we do quantify, you know, we keep a risk register and make a list of those changes. And we go back to the builder and review it with them at the end of the project and say, you know, what would it have cost if we needed to move this in the field? What would it have cost if we discovered this in the field? And our average project, we're mitigating almost $600,000 in risk, you know, on an average $3.5 million build. So we're very proud of that. And I consider that to be a testament of what technology can do today.
Who's your customer?
Our target customer are builders. They're very high-end custom luxury builders. What we find is that when things run over time and over budget, the end customer, whether it's the developer, the homeowner, they're typically looking to the general contractor for their pound of flesh. At that point, most of the design team is gone. They've been paid. Maybe they're coming in and doing spot treatment, you know, or checks in the field, but largely they've been paid and it's hard to claw that money back. That's also a fraction of what they pay the general contractor. And so they're looking to the general contractor to make restitution. So we often go into general contractors and say, well, what are you targeting? If you're targeting a 25% gross margin, you're landing at 15. Where did your 500 basis points go? And often when you look back at the last three projects, builder has their own same repeat offenders. It's my cabinet guy, you know, or it's my painter, or it's my plumbing and concrete guys. And, you know, so normally when you find those negative variances, we typically know where to look to say, okay, here's how we can start mitigating those things so that they're not hurting you in the field any longer.
Can you walk me through a typical project? Let's assume that it's a new custom residential project. Contractor hires you, says, I got this new project. How does it actually work? What's the workflow look like?
Yeah, that's a great question. We assemble the entire team. And often we have builders that will come in and say, okay, I love working with this interior designer. I've been working with this architect for the last 10 years. Don't really care about who does SMEP. You can make a recommendation on civil. Let me know if you have any. So, you know, when we go through, we have a questionnaire that we put them through. And one of the things we want to know is, you know, of all the people you need on your team, who's on it, right? So the first thing that we're doing is supplementing the team and saying, okay, you know, here are the things that you do have. Let's get them in the fold. We have a project.
When you're working with an architect on that team, is that architect part of your team in your company, or is that an independent architect that you're collaborating with?
Sometimes yes, and sometimes no. So what I tell people is, if you want an incredible piece of art, if you're building an 8,000 square foot house on the side of the mountain and you've seen homes by, you know, these named architects, you should work with those architects. You're not going to get their bend of the world. You know, if you've seen five houses that you love by this one architect, don't try and replicate it with somebody else. It's going to be a frustrating experience for you. You have to allow the artist that you love to do the work. If you like Jackson Pollock, you wouldn't ask Monet to go paint a Jackson Pollock type painting. Right. I think about exactly. It the same way. In that circumstance, we really are a service-first organization and trying to do everything right, right? So I'm just in the same way the architect is doing their due diligence. We are doing the same kind of feasibility. You know, do we understand what the lot restrictions are? Do we understand the CC&Rs? Do we understand the code compliance that's required? We will often go out and commission the civil engineer and get a boundary and topo and get some preliminary G&D done. And we're really kind of managing the project in its totality. And by and large, the architects that we work with really enjoy it because it allows them to do what they love. And it's not to say that no architects enjoy drawing. You know, I know a lot of architects that do. But I think what I've found in a lot of cases, particularly in the higher end residential space, is that a lot of the architects really enjoy creating and they enjoy designing. And, you know, what they don't enjoy doing is calling the structural engineer for the third time this week saying, hey, you're going to have a draft for me. You know, what they don't enjoy. So, you know, we lovingly call that the adult daycare part of the business. I find that architects don't enjoy that piece. And then I've been a user of Revit since 2006. And we really use that not just as a drafting tool, but we use it as an infrastructure tool. And I think that there's a difference, right? So it's not just that we're doing 6-inch walls or 8-inch walls. It's what's in that wall assembly. You know, is it 2x6s, 16 inches on center with 1932 OSB and H25s and how much insulation and what type of insulation and interior exterior wall assembly. And that's how we assemble everything, is that we have a real taxonomy and quantification of what's going on. And we don't spend a lot of time drafting. Our sheets are generally, largely 85% of the time auto-generated coming out of the tool. You know, we're spending our time doing our notations, making sure that we've got clear dimensions. But a lot of the things that those architects are doing manually today, we've automated and made a little bit easier, which they really don't care about often until something changes. And now they don't have to go back for the first time and update all their sheets because that's all cascaded through and we've handled the modification of the notations and dimensions. So it takes a little while to get there, but when it works, it really, really works and drives just excellent outcomes. So, you know, we work with a couple of architects where they've been able to take on more business, more interesting kinds of business, and they're using us as their back office. And then they're using us for visualization on the outside, on the inside. You know, we do high quality, not just renderings, but virtual tours and fly-throughs and whatever we need to do in order to be able to communicate what's going on and communicate the design intent accurately to whoever the audience is, whatever stakeholder, whatever AHJ or whatever HOA architectural, you know, review board. It's, everything's a little bit different. When it's all coming out of the same thing, it makes life a lot easier.
Yeah, it's very interesting. It almost sounds like you've built a new model for delivery. How do you define your role? Are you a construction manager? Are you an architect? Are you a software developer?
It's also a great question, but we position ourselves as risk mitigators. You know, we're a technology platform that offers risk mitigation. Can we get you permits? Yes. Can we do the architectural design on an addition that's very, you know, with a 412 roof that's very simple? Yes. I think that's one of the things that's confusing for builders also, is not everything necessitates a super expensive architect. Sometimes good enough is good enough. And then often I find that in between a really competent architect and the person that you're going to find on Facebook or Craigslist or whatever that's going to make your life miserable, they have a hard time kind of finding that happy balance. And I think we do a nice job of that, where when somebody comes to us, a developer comes to us and says, hey, I'm looking to develop 15,000 feet and I want all the bells and whistles and the bowling alley and the shooting range. You want an artist for that. And if you help me get a sense of where you're going or where you're trying to go or what's important to you, we're going to make a recommendation, a few recommendations of people that you should speak to do that art. But here are all the controls that you can put in place by working with us. And it's funny because a lot of people really don't, I have builders that are like, yeah, the visualization guys, you know, we're the visualization guys because we take the interior design spec and put it into a model and show it to them, you know, but we don't do modeling or rendering or VR for the sake of doing it.
Right.
We do it because if we don't do it, the homeowner's not going to see what they're getting until it's in the field. And if they don't agree with it, then it creates problems.
Yeah. The role of risk mitigator also equals more profit, right? At the end of the day, that's what your goal is, right? Is to reduce that risk of mistakes and errors that potentially could become legally expensive, but also mistakes and omissions and errors in your project that costs or substitutions.
Yeah, we see it all the time. You know, we see it all the time. And that's exactly right, is that every time something doesn't work and there's a bust in the field, it's coming out of somebody's pocket. And whoever's pocket it's coming out of is not going to be thrilled about it. And so, look, when we were able to build for $150 a foot or $200 a foot, maybe having 5 or 10% slippage in a project wasn't that big of a deal. Today, the environment is just so much more complex in terms of what clients have access to, the ideas that they get, the regulatory bodies that are increasing regulation, that are increasing the requirements around certain regulations. There's just too much going on for a builder or an architect to unilaterally be in control of that. And this is the only industry where that happens. If you wanted to develop an application, a software application, and you sat down with a person who develops the user interface, and you sat down with a person who creates databases, and you sat down with a person who creates middleware, and you documented it as best you could, and then you handed that to a coder and said, now I want you to go build me a commercially ready product in 30 days or 60 days or 365 days. That developer is going to look at you like you're nuts, because he's going to say, well, I can develop you a proof of concept and we'll go through it and we'll iterate through it. And you're going to tell me what's wrong with it. And then we're going to, at the end of that process, we'll come out with a fully finished product. This is the only industry in the world where somebody hands a stack of paper to a builder and says, now go build me a product.
And make it perfect.
And make it perfect, right? So you're expected to make it perfect, even though you've only been given enough information to make a prototype. And so effectively what we're doing by pressure testing all this stuff and creating a unified version of the truth is exactly that. We're making it product ready before there are shovels in the ground.
Yeah. Let's take a quick break to say thank you to our sponsors for their support of this episode. This episode of Entree Architect Podcast is supported by WeCollabify, one of our trusted allied partners. As this community has grown over the years, one thing has become very clear to me. The partners we choose matter. Allied partners are not sponsors. They're not advertisers. They are organizations that we've taken the time to get to know, to work alongside, and to trust. They understand the real pressures of practice and the responsibility that comes with leading a small firm. WeCollabify earned that trust by helping small firm owners address a challenge that sits at the center of long-term firm health, building capacity in a way that supports people, not just projects. Their insourcing model brings skilled design, BIM, and technical professionals directly into your team. They work in your time zone, inside your systems, and part of your day-to-day workflow. That integration allows firms to add capacity when it's needed, scale with intention, and grow without sacrificing culture, leadership focus, or quality of life. If you're thinking beyond short-term fixes and focused on building a firm that lasts, I encourage you, go learn why WeCollabify is one of our trusted allied partners. Visit WeCollabify.com/EntreeArchitect to learn more. That's WeCollabify.com/EntreeArchitect. Gain lessons learned and credits earned with Arcademy, ARCAT's continuing education program. Listen to popular episodes of the Detailed podcast and earn AIA-approved HSW credits. Yes, you heard that right, HSW credits for episodes of Detailed podcast. Listen to an episode, check out the learning objectives, and use what you've learned while listening to take the course. The program is free, it's simple, and can be found at arcat.com under the Resources tab, or just go to arcat.com/arcademy. That's arcat.com/arcademy. That's arcat.com/arcademy. Please visit our sponsors today and thank them. Thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community. Because it's a new model, sort of a new model, he's taken lots of different pieces and brought them together, but it also proves to be more profitable. Is your service easy to sell or is it difficult to sell? Is it easy because it makes the contractor and the people involved more money, or is it hard to sell because they have to understand what you're doing before they can commit to doing it?
It used to be a much harder sell than it is now. We have a lot of collateral to be able to show.
The more you do it, the more people realize it works.
We have a project that I'm really proud of where we mitigated $600,000 in risk on a $4.5 million bill. But the important and salient part is they're 3 months ahead of schedule, and the entire right down to, you know, the last coping edge. So the bid package is complete. The developer knows exactly what they're getting. They know exactly what it's going to cost. They have great models to be able to create all this marketing, you know, collateral with that we've given to them and their marketing team. And they're going to wind up selling it, you know, before it's complete. They've got four interested parties swirling it now. And so when people are getting done ahead of time and on budget, that gets me really, really excited. You know, that's the system working. So the short answer to your question is we now have about a dozen builders that use us as kind of like a original equipment manufacturer. They used to be at 20%, now they're at 22%, and they just include us in every deal that they do, regardless of how complete they are or aren't. We're just their pre-con front end. So it's getting a little bit easier, but it's taken a long time to get here. It's been a 5-year journey just to arrive at, hey, we're risk mitigators. You know, I used to go in and talk to builders about BIM and virtual design construction, and they would look at me like, is that CAD? What are you talking about? Yeah. Now I don't talk about the technology with those guys. I just show them like, here's a model of a house that we got based on the architectural plans. And then here's what it became after we took everybody's input and put it in there. And then here's the risk register. Here's all the things we found, caught, showed to the customer. They changed, modified. Here's what it would have cost in the field. And that helps them kind of get it.
Yeah, so, you get that pretty quickly. You tie dollars to it and people are like, got it. Understood.
Yeah, we didn't have enough road rash to, or enough experience or data to be able to tie real dollars to it, but we do now and half of the last year. And that's definitely helped in communicating the value proposition.
How big is your team and how much is the process automated in technology and how much of it is work by humans?
Well, we have a team of six. Everybody's here in Scottsdale with the exception of one of our resources. He lives in Portland. But it's a little bit of a loaded question. The short answer is, and we could probably have a whole conversation about AI and what it is and what it isn't. And I blog about this kind of stuff. But yeah. I remember when software came to be and it was going to destroy every business, turn every business on its head. And then suddenly, you know, people realized that, yeah, it was great to be able to attach a copy of an invoice to the record in your ERP system. And that was really convenient. But now I had to match it to a purchase order and a bill of lading. And then that piece was manual. And so, and eventually what you had was all of these little point solutions that eventually rolled up and became solution suites. And I think we're really in the very early innings of that now with respect to AI and respect to automation. And by the way, AI and automation to me are very, very, very close cousins, you know, to one another.
For sure.
Because they both require very structured data, right? So, you know, the notion that you're going to be able to have ChatGPT create an architectural set for you tomorrow, I don't see a path for how we get there in the near term. However, I think that making the most use of building information modeling tools allows you to really, really structure your data in a way that does give you the ability to get some lift out of some AI tools. So for example, if my sheets are always done the same way and I have really, really, I'm not moving things around every time I'm creating a new set of A sheets, it's always standard. You know, we are now playing with tools that allow us to review it for code compliance. You know, now all of a sudden the IRC or the IBC has been updated and take a look at these, you know, 15 sheets and tell me what you see. And the short answer is it doesn't see very much, not well. And you'll get a lot of false positives and you'll get a lot of false negatives. Then you're kind of training an agent, right? So one of the things that we're doing internally with our team is like, you know, so then you're training an agent. But that's where the knowledge base is. The knowledge base is with the person, right? So now, will that human, will that individual be able to probably do 5 to 10x the work that he used to be able to do and do it with a lot more efficiency and precision down the road? Well, we certainly hope so. And that's what we're working towards. But I think the thing that you'll never be able to automate, at least until some laws change, is dealing with the authority having jurisdiction. You know, there's just... those are human beings that are getting younger and younger and have less and less experience. Yep. And that's not a knock on them. That's just the reality. There's a dearth of experience, you know, that's lacking in a lot of the jurisdictions that we have been intersecting with. And I just don't see that changing either anytime soon. And that's not an AI problem, right? That's really sort of more of like a standardization, you know, kind of problem. So long-winded way of saying, I think people that when we work with new clients and they come in, they can't believe how much we've automated or how much AI we have, or, you know, that these systems really make a lot of sense in terms of how they follow a certain chronology. But it feels pretty basic to me. You know, I feel like we're just kind of driving some of the efficiencies into the AEC space today that every other industry was doing 20, 25 years ago. So
I agree. Yep. So what does the future look like for Cradle? Let's say 3 years from now, because, you know, the future's tomorrow.
So I've really been pressure testing this as a B2B offering. You know, can we make it work for builders? Can we make it work for architects? Can we make it work for interior designers? And I think we've proven out that we can. My BHAG, as the entrepreneurs call it.
For anybody who doesn't know, BHAG is Big Hairy Audacious Goal.
Thank you. Yes. So my Big Hairy Audacious Goal is, I'd like Cradle to become a household name. You know, I'd like it to be a B2C offering where customers can go and say, I'm ready to put an accessory dwelling unit in my backyard, or mom's moving in and we have to create, or whatever the circumstances are, and have a place to go. You know, and we actually do have customer facing tools that we're playing with now where a customer can go onto our website, they can put in an email address and it will wizard them through. What's the livable envelope look like? And what does the non-livable envelope look like? And what does the site look like? And it really starts to ask them questions in a logical fashion that allows them to, one, understand the complexity of what goes into this. But two, as they're answering questions, they can see the numbers, the total number growing, and it spits out a line item detail budget at the end of it. So it gives people the ability to self-select out. It gives people the ability to right-size their scope, you know, to price. So that's one thing that we're finding customers really like. The other thing that we're finding that customers really like is the whole virtual experience, you know, where they can put on a headset and walk through their house and experience it. They can see the fireplace roaring. They can see the rain curtain with the water coming down, all the things that make it a really immersive experience for them. And I believe that with the structured information we have in building information modeling and virtual design construction, and all the data that we have on costing and our ability to provide virtual experiences, I think those three things are going to converge where, you know, as a homeowner, you'll be able to, you know, even kind of come up with like a loose concept to give to your architect. Like we're playing with tools that do that now. You've answered all these questions in the wizard and here's what your house could look like. It's a two-story, eight-shaped, 5,500 square foot house with a three-car garage and a 612 roof and, you know, on a lot that's with a 6-foot drop and in this neighborhood. So you can kind of see that, again, AI is not going to figure out, you know, AI will put three kitchens in your house and one powder room. You know, AI is not going to figure out what needs to actually go inside that box. But I could see a world where it kind of creates a starting point, you know, so that their inspiration is coming from something other than Pinterest. It's coming from something they actually answer their own questions around and can afford.
Yeah, definitely.
And now, whoever the architect is of record can now take that, take the program, really start to do their art, and then put it back in the bucket so that now we can make sure that everything else is coordinated for them and everybody can kind of go on with their life. I also think, and this is something that we're starting to play with now with like the Autodesk API and, okay, if I know that we have a 48-inch Wolf range, you know, here and the customer doesn't want to spend the money or now wants to look at a 48-inch Thermidor, they should be able to, in the goggles, in the VR headset, go shopping and say, okay, in my appliance package, I have a 48-inch Wolf range, but I want to see what the 48-inch Thermidor looks like. Oh, I can save $3,500. Let's add that to the cart. And they can put that in there. So My BHAG is I think we can virtualize the entire design center experience and make it much more streamlined as opposed to the way it works today, where specifications are coming in from all over the place. The builder's trying to keep up. Every time something changes, he's going back to his plans. He's doing a new takeoff. He's now going out to his vendor. Hopefully nobody fat fingered anything and got it right, but often that's not the case. I think actually streamlining all of that, where if you know what the object is and the customer looked at it, priced it, liked it, that they should just be able to put it in a basket and buy it directly from your vendor. And then there are economic pieces of that. But I think if we could streamline, you know, the design details, make sure that everything's cohesive from a design standpoint, that the customer had the ability to create budget and scope from the onset, and that there was this very visual, what we call dynamic design, because design doesn't stop until the home is delivered.
Right.
You know, so we can continue to make sure that we're kind of keeping up with the pace of things and that new information is getting out to the field so that it's relevant and mitigate that risk. I think it could be a wonderful experience for, you know, homeowners who today literally have no idea where to get started.
Yeah, very much so. That is definitely a huge problem in our industry, and it has been for decades or centuries.
Yeah, at least for the three decades that I've been focused on it, it's been something that has really, really just irritated me.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Well, I'm glad that you're doing something about it. It sounds like a very interesting model, very inspiring. Before we wrap up here, you've built a couple of businesses, some of them more successful than others.
Always.
In your own words.
Yep, that's right.
You're talking to thousands of architects. Most of them are business owners. What would you say is one thing that a small firm architect can do today to build a better business for tomorrow?
Well, I would argue that they should look at our tools because they're designed to do exactly that. But on the whole, and this is not even specific to architecture, I just think we're in an environment where we all need to lean into the technology a little bit, you know, and in this business in particular, there's this sort of white knuckling the way we've always done things. And the interesting part about that is because the complexity is going up and homeowner expectations are going up and costs are going up, it's actually adding more complexity to the delivery for the builder and the homeowner, our mutual customer that we're all trying to make happy. So the two bits of advice I give are, one, know your numbers. I don't care what business you're in, know your numbers. And two, lean into the technology. You don't have to lean into all of it, but just figure out a problem that you're having and in earnest, see and investigate how technology can help you solve that one thing. Because just like anything else, it will compound and it will build on itself and it'll give you more confidence that you can solve other problems, you know, with a little spot treatment, you know, from something that maybe you hadn't given consideration to before.
His name is Adam Katz. The company is Cradle with a Y, C-R-A-Y-D-L, C-R-A-Y-D-L. Website is cradle.com. And before we push the big record button here, you were telling me about a tool that you have. You want to share a little bit about the tool?
Yeah. And I was speaking about it earlier because a little bit about it earlier in the context of how we service end customers that they can go on and create. But we actually have a version of it that is for architects and builders. So one of the biggest challenges that I see, and I've seen this a lot, is somebody hires an architect and the architect designs something and they're doing their best to not just meet the aesthetic requirements and the functional requirements, but also the budgetary requirements. And the budgetary requirements always seem to come last, right? Because we're artists and we like to design and we like to make customers happy and we like to get the ooh and ah, and I can't wait to live in that, you know, but at some point, somebody's gonna have to pay for that. So we do see a lot of things that are really, really designed in a way that will not meet the budgetary needs of that customer. And so we've developed a tool. You can find it at budget.cradle.com. But it really allows you to go through a 12-step wizard and establish what's in the livable envelope, what's in the non-livable envelope, what are we cladding the house in, what are the site conditions. And there's a room builder. You can go room by room and you can set up defaults if you're always designing with the same appliance package, but you can also really kind of start to dial it in. And we're pulling in information. We're pulling in the catalogs from Wolf and Sub-Zero and all that kind of stuff. So it's an experience that allows you to sit with your client and educate them and make sure that whatever you're designing is aligned with, you know, their scope and budgetary expectations from the onset. And we've found that to be a tremendous tool. We recommend using it right at the beginning when you meet with the client, but then also using it again after you have completed your concept and maybe you're halfway through schematic design. So, you know, before you start getting into design development and engaging interiors and landscape details and getting all your SMEP done, that's a good time to stop and say, okay, well, we were looking to build 4,200 feet with a 3-car garage. We wound up designing 4,500 feet with a 4-car garage and a roof deck. And, you know, now we've added in our negative edge pool. We do that a lot out here in Arizona. And is this number still comfortable? Because if not, now's the time, right?
Right.
Once we get this past this point, things start getting considerably more expensive to change, right? So, and we've had really good success doing that internally with our own clients. We have customers of this calculator tool that have also been really successful in making sure that they're not missing steps. And the best feedback that I, you know, you're even going through, again, lot conditions, how much cut fill, you know, do you think you'll need, you know, how many lineal feet of retaining walls, the house sitting on top of any of it, all the things that the customer doesn't even really think about. And so you've really left them in a position where they understand as best as they can what they're getting, what it's going to cost, what it's going to look like from 30,000 feet as opposed to not at all. And make sure that you're being true to that as you're going through the process.
Cool. So it's budget.cradle.com.
Correct.
Again, it's CRADL.com. Adam, thank you. And thanks for sharing your story here today. This has been a really interesting conversation. And I love how you're reinventing the process. And it actually sounds very intuitive, the way that you're doing it. So thank you for sharing that and inspiring us and motivating us to look at the way we do things as well as architects. And maybe we can figure out new ways of being more efficient or even looking at some of your tools and maybe integrating them into our process. So thanks for doing that. And thanks for coming by here and sharing your knowledge at Entree Architect Podcast.
Mark, thanks for having me.
If you enjoyed this episode of Entree Architect Podcast, please share a link with a friend, because that's how we've continued to grow and serve thousands more small firm architects just like you. Thank you to our sponsors for this episode. Links to the sponsors and all the resources we discussed today, they are all available in the show notes for this episode at entrearchitect.com/podcast. Entree Architect is a proud member of the Gable Media Network. It's the multimedia network moving the architecture, engineering, and construction industries forward through the power of storytelling. You can earn AIA continuing education credits by listening to select episodes of this podcast and many others at gablemedia.com/members. And if you are a small firm architect, listen up. Join us today at Entree Architect Network. It's the worldwide community for entrepreneur architects. We've been around since 2012, and our basic level is now free to join. Yes, you can join Entree Architect Network for free. And that gives you access to valuable business resources and our global community of architects. And you can upgrade anytime for live coaching, AIA approved training, and mastermind support. So visit entrearchitect.com to learn more and to get started. My name is Mark R. LePage. Thank you for listening to the Entree Architect podcast. Love, learn, share. Are you NCARB certified yet? Join the network of over 45,000 architects who have the NCARB certificate to expand your professional reach. By becoming NCARB certified, you are demonstrating that you've met the national standards for licensure, a qualification that can be an important factor for firms when hiring and promoting. Certificate holders have a streamlined path to apply for a reciprocal license in all 55 U.S. jurisdictions, as well as access to an extensive library of free continuing education courses. Learn more today at ncarb.org.